Okay, I want to tell you today about the influence of thermal noise on non-equilibrium pattern forming systems near bifurcations. Now, I don't know whether thermal noise plays a significant role in biological systems. We've heard a bit about shot noise. I would think thermal noise might play a role because it becomes important when the systems are small and when the system is near an instability. And I think those two conditions are quite often met also in biology. But that's all I want to say about that. I'm going to discuss first Rayleigh-Binard convection, which surprisingly, over 2 days into this conference, has not yet been mentioned, so far as I know. It is a horizontal layer of fluid, which is heated from below, and it has some thickness D, and we get a temperature difference delta T across it. And when delta T exceeds a critical value, delta TC, then convection starts and convection forms a pattern. There are a few parameters in this problem. One of them is the Prandtl number. It's the ratio of the kinematic viscosity to the thermal diffusivity. And another important parameter is this epsilon. Epsilon is the dimensionless measure of the distance from the bifurcation point. So when epsilon is positive, you can see that we are in the convecting state. When epsilon is negative, we are below the onset of convection. I also, on this slide, want to mention my co-workers. The work on Rayleigh-Binard convection was done to a large extent by Jae-Chul Oh, who now has seen greener pastures and found a job at NRL. And Nathan Becker has been helpful to us in the image analysis. Nathan, I think most of you have met. He's here with us and will speak tomorrow. And I will then later talk about electroconvection, and the co-workers there are Michael Scherer, who has now returned to Germany, Xinliang Chu, who's here with us, and Shangxi Zhao, who also is somewhere in the audience. Okay. Now, going back a few years, we have looked at this problem, oh, back in 95, when Mingming Wu was a postdoc here in Santa Barbara, and she made some very beautiful measurements of fluctuations below the onset of Rayleigh-Binard convection. And it was a very difficult job to see anything at all. And in fact, Mingming believes, and I believe, that there are fluctuations in this picture. This is a shadowgraph image of a little bit of convecting fluid looking from above. But if you don't believe that there really is any significant structure in here, you can look here at the square of the modulus of the Fourier transform, which we call the structure factor. And in the structure factor, you see a ring. And the ring has a radius that corresponds to the critical wave number for the onset of Rayleigh-Binard convection. So that's pretty convincing evidence that these are indeed fluctuations occurring here. Now let's look at the numbers a little bit. Swift and Hornberg gave us an analysis of this problem way back in 1977. And Van Buren and Cohen helped us a little further in 1988 to get the numbers straight. And this is the effective noise intensity that the system sees. Okay, it is a ratio of KT to some macroscopic energy, rho nu squared D, times, well, there's another factor there. There's basically a Prandtl number sitting there. You can see here that the effective noise intensity goes up when the system becomes small. Okay, that's where the small system comes into play. But if we stick some numbers into this formula and look at a typical convection experiment using water, we get something like 10 to the minus 9 for the effective thermal noise intensity. And that is pretty hopeless in terms of doing experiments. Mingming worked with compressed carbon dioxide at a pressure of around different pressures, 29 and 42 bar. Then F is of order 10 to the minus 7, and she was able to indeed make some measurements. If we now take this Fourier ring and we integrate around it and get the total power, you can plot the total power here against minus epsilon. We're below the bifurcation. You can see the data points and the lines, solid lines, are the theoretical prediction based on these people here without any adjustable parameters. This is a very beautiful confirmation of linear fluctuating hydrodynamics as written down, for instance, by Landau and Lifshitz. The prediction is that the fluctuation power should go as 1 over the modulus of epsilon to some power, and the power is 1/2 in the linear theory. Well, that's all well and good, but really what we would like to see is a breakdown of linear theory, which we would get if we went further in, because that breakdown of linear theory would then lead to genuine critical phenomena, which, in analogy to equilibrium critical points, would give us fluctuation renormalization of critical exponents, or, as Pierre and Jack Swift predicted a long time ago, in this particular case, it would lead to a fluctuation-induced first-order phase transition. Well, how can we reach that? Not with Ming-Ming's system, but if we go to a part of a phase diagram close to a critical point of a gas, then it turns out this F thermal goes to infinity. You can see it from this formula. This is all pretty much constant. It doesn't change very much. Viscosity is about constant, but the thermal diffusivity goes to zero at the critical point as you move along the critical iso core. So here we are, temperature density, phase separation curve. Here's the liquid, here's the vapor, and here's the critical iso core. As we move down here, this F thermal goes to infinity because of this vanishing of the thermal diffusivity. So we can place ourselves somewhere along here where F thermal has a convenient value to give us whatever noise intensity we want. And in practice, we have worked at 46.5 degrees and 48 degrees centigrade. That corresponds to this point and that point. And the thermal noise intensity is in the vicinity of 10 to the minus 4. Certainly much more convenient than what Ming-Ming had to struggle with. So I will talk about two experiments, one on this isobar and another one on that isobar. And that's the work with Jachal O. We'll take the lower one first. We'll take this isobar first. So the data I show you are there. Here are shadowgraph images of the fluid visualized from above. The fluid is 34 micrometers thick, and we are looking at a 1.28 by 1.28 square millimeter area. Here you see convection rolls. That is an epsilon of 0.007, just above the bifurcation. Here we are just below the bifurcation, and you see nothing but fluctuations. And here we are 5% below the bifurcation, still see fluctuations, but they are more disordered at this point. On the right side, you see the...
How do you identify epsilon equals zero to pre-significant?
Well, we probably know it to plus or minus 2 in this place. And you can simply see by eye when you go from this to that. It's a very sharp transition. I can quantify it in terms of some statistical measure of the pattern, but I don't need to, but you will also see in a minute. Okay, so here are the Fourier transforms. Here we have rolls, give us two Fourier spots. And here the fluctuations give us a ring and Fourier space. And the ring reflects the fact that Rayleigh-Binard convection is invariant under rotation. And this, indeed, is a crucial ingredient of the Swift-Hohenberg prediction that we should have a fluctuation-induced first-order phase transition. The rotational invariance puts the system into the Brazovsky universality class, which has this particular feature. Just a few weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago, I got a preprint from Harry Swinney's group. They are vibrating a layer of sand vertically, and they are looking at fluctuations. That's a snapshot, and that is the average of 100 Fourier transforms of such snapshots. And lo and behold, there's a ring in Fourier space. There are fluctuations in that system. Epsilon is minus 0.06 here, so it's directly comparable to this. It looks a little different, but it has a lot in common too. The noise intensity here is higher than it is there. I'll speak about that in a moment. And the noise intensity here is not due to KT, but rather due to the collisions between the particles. So it's the physics, in some sense, is different, but the phenomenology, the observables, are somewhat similar. Pardon? The transition is to a pattern of squares in this case. Okay, a square. They're not convection rolls, but well, I don't really want to discuss the granular case at great length. It's kind of fun to look at the fluctuations below the bifurcation in the form of a movie, and you have here the epsilon values above these four panels, and you can now see rapid fluctuations, 6% below, somewhat slower fluctuations, and some greater correlation, 0.3% below. This is what I call zero, plus or minus 0.002, and this is what I call just above. And you see we have now formed the rolls. Going back here, we can again simply integrate in Fourier space, get the total power of the fluctuations. And the total power is plotted here against epsilon on linear scales. Here it is plotted on log-log scales, where we take log of minus epsilon, or log of the modulus of epsilon. We take log of the modulus because these data are now above the bifurcation up here, and the solid circles are below the bifurcation. The solid line is a fit of the prediction of Swift and Hohenberg to the data, and the fit gives 7 times 10 to the minus 4 for the noise intensity, and from the fluid properties we estimate 5 times 10 to the minus 4. So this is closer than I would have expected it to be. To me, reasonably convincing evidence for this being a first-order phase transition is what's shown here. We're looking at the fluctuation power as a function of time. Here we are just above the bifurcation. The delta T across the cell is 146 millidegrees. And the power is more or less constant in time. It jumps around a little, as it should. But at 145.5, there are transitions. It looks more or less like a bistable system that likes to be either up here or down there. And up here is the roll state. It's A and C, A and C. Down here is the fluctuating state. That's B and D. So you could not have this kind of a transition between a roll state and a fluctuating state with a large jump in the power, a factor of 2 in the power, if this were not a first order transition. We can look at the movie for that particular transition. Here we have rolls crystallized, and pretty soon it'll melt. It's melting. And then a little bit, now it's freezing again into an ordered state. And then now it's melting and it's going to stay molten for the rest of the time. Let's now go to the other isobar. The sample is 59 micrometers thick, this upper isobar. Again, here are data just like the ones I described before. power against epsilon on a log scale. That should be the modulus of epsilon. Experimentally, by fitting the Swift-Hohenberg prediction to the data, we get 1.4 times 10 to the minus 4 in this case, quite a bit lower. We expect that. From the fluid properties, we get 0.8. So again, there's very nice agreement. Again, in this case, if we park ourselves right at what I boldly call epsilon equals 0, 0 plus or minus something, this is again the fluctuation power. It undergoes transitions, various transitions. And here are three examples of the images down here at a low spot, have fluctuations. At a high spot, we have rolls. And at an intermediate spot, we have, well, fluctuations, but they are semi-organized in rolls. Okay, so again, the same thing we saw before. Now I want to address what happens in the so-called ordered state. This was discussed by Tono and Nelson already, I dread to think, over 20 years ago. They envisioned that there should be various thermal excitations on the rolls that should be observable. They said there should be two kinds of phonons, they called them phonons, undulatory ones and compressional ones. And there should be various kinds of defects, dislocations and disclinations. Disclinations would be very rare. Their energy goes to infinity as the system diverges. Dislocations have a finite excitation energy and might be seen. So the question is, what do we see of this? Well, we see some things that they didn't envision. I call your attention again to the Fourier transform here, to the structure factor. And I don't know whether you can see that there's a faint ring going all the way around. It may not be visible because it's structure factor is dominated by the two main Fourier peaks. But if you plot the intensity around the ring as a function of angle, you get these open circles. And that's a big peak. Okay. And now if you then filter away all this stuff and retain only the main peak in Fourier space, note this is a log scale, right? So we have this is two decades higher than the fluctuations. So if you filter that away and you back transform, you get this picture from that picture. Now the main difference I see is that there are little pearls along the rolls here, and the little pearls are gone here. Okay, so those little pearls are the superposition of fluctuations of all orientations on top of the main roll structure that persists. I can now measure the power that is in these fluctuations by ignoring that peak, taking it out, and just taking the power under the fluctuating part. And when I do that, I get these open circles here. And when I measure the power of the fluctuations below the bifurcation, that is in the purely fluctuating state, I get these solid circles. So what I see is that the fluctuation power is perfectly symmetric about the Rayleigh-Binard bifurcation. Symmetry. Right? The two branches are equal. Right? The solid circles agree with the open circles. The open circles are above the bifurcation. Solid ones are below. Okay? So that's one result that had not been anticipated. What else? Well, we can take the picture and we can Fourier demodulate it. And by demodulation techniques, we can get the magnitude of this field. Okay, so we get just the magnitude of those rolls as a function of position. That's shown here. And you see the structure and the magnitude. Two talks ago, I think that amplitude modulation was neglected, probably rightly so. But here we see this amplitude modulation in this case. There are interesting correlations, which we haven't studied in detail. In the direction of the wave director, the correlation is of longer range than along the roll axis. This is something worth investigating further. Thank you. We can also take this image and do a local wave director analysis. That gives us the local magnitude of the wave director and the local direction of the wave director. The magnitude is here. Doesn't have much structure in it. That means Toner and Nelson's compressional phonons did not show up. Or we didn't have the resolution to see them, or they're absent, one or the other. But this is a grayscale rendering of the angle of the wave director of this picture. And you see that the angle has structure in it. And that tells me that the undulatory phonons are present. Okay. And here is a movie of the angle. This is now a color rendering of the angle of the wave director, and you can see it. Forget about this. There are some defects up there. But you can see that the phonons move around. They change in time on a relatively slow time scale. Well, I really want to move on to the second topic that I wanted to discuss. Rayleigh-Binard convection is not the only game in town. It is belongs to the Brazovsky universality class, which is very interesting, but there are non-equilibrium pattern forming systems that should belong to different universality classes, and it would be nice to find some of those. And in electroconvection in a nematic liquid crystal, we can do that. The system consists of a nematic. The director of the nematic is oriented. It is either oriented as shown here, which is called planar alignment. It's parallel to the top and bottom plate. Or it could be also oriented vertically in this picture so that the director would be orthogonal to the confining plates. That's called homeotropic alignment. If we apply a voltage to the system, then when the voltage amplitude exceeds a critical value, convection will start. Okay, so we're not using temperature to drive it, we're using an electric voltage. The epsilon parameter is V0 over Vc squared minus 1. And there's a drive frequency, omega. Okay, so omega is the angular frequency of the AC voltage that we use. Well, we can have a number of different patterns. In particular, we can have so-called oblique rolls that make an angle with the director. The director is this way. And for these oblique rolls, the wave director is this way. Okay, so the wave director with the liquid crystal director makes an angle theta. And if we have zag rolls, these are called zag, we can also have zig rolls. The two modes are degenerate in this system. That's because the director doesn't have a head or tail. Now, experimentally, the angle theta as a function of drive frequency behaves in this fashion. And here, the rolls are so-called normal rolls. Normal rolls would have their axis orthogonal to the director. Now, that's an interesting diagram because there's a very special point here, this very special point where the oblique angle just vanishes is a Lipschitz point, well known in equilibrium critical systems, and Lipschitz point has special critical properties. Now, there is no reason why oblique rolls should have the same critical behavior as normal rolls. If you look at the structure of the Ginzburg-Landau equations for these, which, by the way, our fearless leader Eberhard has written down in his PhD thesis, a few years ago, then we find that the gradient terms here look different from the gradient terms here. Okay, so one could reasonably expect different critical behavior there and also in the middle. Well, this again just shows experimentally the Rayleigh-Binard case with that real space image. The electroconvection oblique roll case leads to this structure factor where we just have the four spots. Clearly a different symmetry from that, okay? And definitely not Brazovsky. Well, how many universality classes can we imagine? quite a few. For planar alignment, we can have a stationary bifurcation that can lead to normal oblique or oblique rolls or to a Lipschitz point. We can have those same three for the case of a Hopf bifurcation in this system, because there can be a supercritical bifurcation to traveling waves. And we can have a codimension 2-point, which is a point where the Hopf bifurcation would meet the stationary bifurcation. For the homeotropic alignment, there are at least two cases. The simplest would be to go directly to electroconvection, and that would belong to the Brzozowski universality class, because for homeotropic alignment, the system is rotationally invariant. Okay, so that should be like really benign and should be a fluctuation-induced first-order transition. But quite often, the electroconvection transition is preceded by a Frederick's transition, which sort of buckles the director and thereby selects a particular orientation. So those would be two different cases. Well, what do we know about it by now? Michael Scherer measured oblique traveling waves, fluctuations, in a material called I52, open circles here. This is a power against epsilon. The power is on a log scale. There's no indication of a first order transition. Everything is nice and smooth. Xin Liang has more recently worked on N4, which leads to stationary oblique rolls. They're both oblique. This is the traveling wave, and it's a stationary pattern. And lo and behold, the stationary one looks quite different. It's qualitatively different. I mean, your eye can tell you that you would need different exponents to describe that. Here on a log-log scale, we have the stationary case here and the Hopf case up here. And also dashed in is the 1/2 exponent line, which the linear theory would predict. And we see positive deviations from the linear theory here and negative deviations there. Again, illustrating dramatically different critical behavior for these two different systems. Well, now unfortunately, we would really love to have some theory to help us further along in interpreting our data, because we don't quite know what to fit this to. So we are faced with the following situation. Way out here, we would expect the linear prediction to be valid, which predicts that the fluctuation diverges at epsilon equals zero. Of course, we know it can't diverge because it has to saturate due to nonlinear interactions. Right? But this exponent of 1/2 can become renormalized due to fluctuations and due to fluctuation interaction to some other exponent. But eventually, it still has to saturate, because the power has to stay finite at the bifurcation point. So we have to go from some renormalized exponent to some saturation at the bifurcation. And if we had a complete theory, it would tell us exactly how this happens, just as Swift and Holmberg have told us how that happens in really Rayleigh-Binard, including the first order transition. But we don't have these theories. So we do a poor man's theory. We say we need a crossover. We have a power law far away, and we have a constant close in, and we take a crossover as 1 over p1 plus 1 over p0 to the minus 1. You could replace the minus 1 and put an exponent on here and get 1 over that exponent there, whatever. When we fit the data to this function, we extract for stationary rolls, we extract these numbers for the exponent. Now here's the Lipschitz point. We see an exponent near 0.9 for oblique rolls far away from the Lipschitz point, about 0.4 well above the Lipschitz point, and then there seems to be a continuous variation. But of course, we shouldn't be fooled by that, because there really should be a crossover that gradually takes us from oblique rolls through Lipschitz to normal rolls, and we would not necessarily expect to ever see the pure behavior of any one of the three. Okay, so I'm not surprised that this is a seemingly continuous variation. The oblique traveling waves are down here, which we saw already earlier, completely different from that. Well, I suspect my time's up. Here's a summary. Okay, fluctuations near the really benign stability have been measured, and we have a first order phase transition that is induced by the fluctuations. We've looked at the fluctuations in the striped phase or in the convecting roll phase, and there are phonons, and there is amplitude modulation and roll angle modulation. And I haven't shown it to you because of time, but there are also dislocations that form spontaneously due to the thermal excitations. We've seen fluctuations near oblique traveling waves in I52, fluctuations near oblique and normal stationary bifurcations in N4, and the Lipschitz point in between. And here's again an enumeration of some of the possible universality classes I discussed earlier, and the ones that are given in bold print are the ones that we have looked at so far. Well, again, I don't know how much this will carry over to systems that may be of interest in biology, but again, because these systems are often very, very small, and because these systems are often near instabilities, I suspect that thermal noise may play a role in them. I think I'll close at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a comment, the shaking grains experiment is actually first order.
This is right. They say it's weakly first order.
Is it possible that it's Brzozowski first order too?
No. They don't claim that it's fluctuation-induced first order. I think they believe that it at the linear level, at the mean field level, would be first order. But I'm not sure the answer is known to that. Anyway, they fit the fluctuations to the Swift-Hohenberg equation. I'm not going to defend it one way or the other. It's not my system.
Well, it's a strange system. Temperature is some kind of granular temperature.
Yeah, that's right. I just thought I'd throw it up there for comparison. They do get a ring in Fourier space, which is sort of neat.
But you say they have evidence that it is first order?
Yeah, that's
what
been
kind
known.
Of evidence? Is it dynamical like yours?
No. I think they look at the amplitudes. You know, you probably know better than I do.
It's hard to measure the amplitudes
quantitatively because you don't have shadow graph,
yeah,
really.
But I bet they can see
them. Just
jump.
By eye and so on, it's hysteretic.
Yeah.
So that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments?
I got a little confused. I mean, during your last part of your talk. And I was wondering, what would be the criterion to be full? I mean, to be belong to be this Brzozowski universality class? You haven't mentioned about it, I think.
Well, I mentioned it a little bit. I should probably let our chair speak to that since he's the expert. But basically, the order parameter has to have an infinite number of degrees of freedom at the bifurcation point. And in the really benign case, it acquires that by virtue of the rotational invariance. In other words, rolls of all orientations go unstable simultaneously. Maybe Pierre wants to comment on that, but basically, I think if you have this rotational invariance, it should put it in the Brzozowski universality class. If it was a second-order transition in the first place, now the granular thing probably isn't. But.
So it's got to be a second-order transition and should have a rotational symmetry.
Yeah.
That's
the ordered state has to have rotational symmetry,
right.
Not the order parameter.
Yeah.
It's not enough that the order parameter has rotational symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ordered state. So an anti-ferromagnet in a solid, the ordered state doesn't, because the lattice is of the anti-ferromagnetic lattice is
pinned to the solid lattice. But an anti-ferromagnetic liquid, the ordered state would have rotational symmetry, and that is the system that Brzozowski. I mean, why? Why did anybody? Was anybody perverse enough to think about this? It's because he was thinking about antiferromagnetic liquids or analogons to antiferromagnetic liquids, and we were lucky that he had done that, because that's a pretty clever theory, and we were able to be parasitic to that theory.
Deviations from what?
Well, from the what we just talked about.
If you took break the rotational symmetry.
Right, if you weakly break the rotational symmetry by inclination, you could slowly go to the isotropic case and see what happens.
Well, these experiments are pretty difficult anyway without tilting.
Well, it wouldn't be.
No, it would be interesting. It could be done. Yeah, could be done.
Are there other questions or comments? I mean, it may well be that that there are a lot fewer.
Yeah.
That a lot of these are either you have a continuous symmetry or you don't.
Well, I don't think that's the case, because experimentally we know that the Hopf case, for instance, is different from the from the stationary case.
Right.
And we know that the oblique roles are different from the normal roles.
It could be a crossover, though. I mean,
okay.
One is always safe in saying maybe you're not in the critical region. I realize that.
Yeah.
You can't. When you're talking about critical exponents, I've come to the conclusion that you can never prove a theory. You can only, by experiment, you can only falsify
a theory. These are pretty gross effects.
Yeah, but, you know, they may agree up there.
Well, of course they agree up there.
But right.
I mean, they have to go to a constant. They agree in that sense. But right. What is a crossover function that takes us there?
Right.
Well, if you try the empirical crossover function I showed you, you get different exponents out of this crossover.
Right.
Okay. Now, we would love to have a more detailed theory.
Right. Well, I promised you one. I just haven't delivered.
You all heard it.